So we ready to roll? Awesome. Well, thank you for coming to the Windows Azure at Fabric Caching Talk. Let's see, about 8 of you. So it's the end of the day. Hopefully people come in. Everyone's getting a little tired. But yeah, my name is Wade Wegner. I'm a technical evangelist for the Windows Azure platform. And so what I'm going to talk about is the caching service, which coincidentally is actually going into production tomorrow. So this is a great time to start looking at and thinking about the caching service. What we're going to do is walk through, and over the next 75 minutes, I want to first present, you know, what are the challenges that the Windows Azure App Fabric caching service is aiming to solve. So what is difficult about building highly performant web applications? I'm also going to go through, and in doing that, I'm going to give an overview of the Windows Azure App Fabric caching service. I've got a lot of demos, so I want to show you a lot of these demos. We're going to talk through some of the sizes and capacity for the caching service. Best practices, some tips and tricks based on how you can go about thinking of using the cache, and then if there's time, some Q&A. So when we look at the challenges, like what are the challenges people face when building highly performant and scalable web applications, I propose that these here are some of them. The first is, how do you linearly scale your application? Now, the reason I think it's important to think about it in a linear fashion is the fact that when you go to deploy your web application and you look to start scaling it, if you have to use some kind of a curve in order to estimate the need or the ability to scale it, it makes it a lot more complex. So if you can take some of the complexity out of the situation and think about having just one server, two servers, four servers, etc., and having a linear scale of performance increases, it makes it a lot easier to solve challenges. Also, how do you get better performance and reduce data access latencies? You know, what do you do to reduce the network traffic and the network hops that you need to take in order to access data? And what do you do to actually reduce the amount of pressure that's being put on your data tier? In many cases, you may be extracting data from multiple sources and multiple repositories. For instance, there's the Windows Azure Data Market. And the Windows Azure Data Market is a data repository where you can query data via OData and consume it in your application. And in many cases, you want to take that data to enrich data you already have. And so rather than having to continually query this data and mash it up on the fly, you can cache it and find ways of storing the aggregate of that data in one place. And then how, in Windows Azure, how do you take the session state and externalize it somewhere that not only is supported by Microsoft, but makes it easy? There's some challenges today in that when you look at SQL Azure and externalizing session state into SQL Azure, there's some challenges given the fact that we don't provide a SQL agent to clean out the stale sessions. Additionally, with Windows Azure Table Storage, you also need to have something that's responsible for clearing out these stale sessions. So there's really hasn't been a very particularly good answer for externalizing session state within applications running in Windows Azure. And I talked about this already, but how do you go about reducing the pressure that's put on your data tier? Now, there's a lot of work being done at Microsoft and with SQL Azure to build distributed and partitionable sharded databases. But in many cases, you just want to reduce the load. You don't need to go through the complexity of sharding and partitioning your relational database. So these are some of the challenges. And then finally, how do you do this with the predictable cost model so that you're taking the guesswork out of scale? And so these are some of the challenges and things that the team at Microsoft and the Windows Azure App Fabric team have been thinking about trying to solve with the caching service. And so what we would suggest and what we think solves these problems is having an in-memory distributed cache. And what I mean by that is it's an in-memory cache, meaning that the data is actually stored in memory. It never gets written to disk. So there's no disk I/O, there's no cost for writing and reading from the disk. Everything is in memory where it's very fast to read and write. Also, it's located near your application. So when you use the Windows Azure App Fabric caching service, you would co-locate it along with your application so that you minimize the network hops and you take advantage of the extremely fast bandwidth available within the data center. And by doing so, this reduces the pressure on your data tier, because instead of having to continually go off and hit SQL Azure or continually having to go off and grab a composite of both data coming from your data tier as well as something like Windows Azure Data Market, instead you can put that in the cache and put the burden on the cache, which is exactly what it's designed for. Additionally, One of the things about the caching service is that it is a managed service. So you don't have to deal with the complexity of setting up and configuring and managing a clustered in-memory cache and distributed cache. It's provided as a service. It's as simple as clicking a create button, having it created, and then using it. And so what you can choose is when you go to deploy and provision the cache, you can select the size that's most appropriate to you. And based on the size, there'll be an appropriate cost. And so you'll only pay for what you use based on the size cache you select. And then finally, you're going to be reducing your overall TCO, because the premise is that by offloading this work into the caching service, you're able to reduce the investments you need to make elsewhere, such as your data tier. And then finally, it's extremely simple to integrate this within the application. And I'll show you a bunch of demos that shows this. We also provide out-of-the-box support for a number of different things. I already alluded to the ASP.NET session state. So there is a distributed session state provider that's shipped with the SDK. And we also support page output caching as well through the assembly. All right, so with that, I want to go ahead and show a demo from start to finish. Using the caching service. And the way I'm going to start it is I want to take you first to the portal. Now, I said tomorrow this will be available in production. So today I'm going to use the CTP environment. And to do that, I'm going to go here to portal.atfabriclabs.com. And you can see if you want to see it. So it's portal.atfabriclabs.com. I believe this will stay available for a little while, even after we release to production. So you should still be able to do this for a little bit. And I'm going to go ahead and log in with my live ID. Now, this environment is a replica of the production environment, except that it's specific to AppFabric services. So you see we're missing a number of the buttons that come with the standard Windows Azure portal experience. But down here, we do have the service bus access control and caching. And so if I select this button, you can see here that I've got access to the access control, service bus, and cache, and select the cache, and now here is where I can interact with and create caches. I have a couple already provisioned, and what I want to do for this talk is create a new cache, and then I'm going to use this cache throughout the talk. So to create a new cache, we have this concept of a namespace. And so what I'm going to do is create a new namespace, and essentially you can think of a namespace as being your slice of the app fabric. All of the app fabric services run as multi-tenant services, meaning they're distributed across many different instances running in Windows Azure. And so when I create a new namespace, I'm essentially creating a slice of the app fabric which I can use. And so I'm going to go ahead and create a new namespace. And you see I've got a subscription name. I'm going to go ahead and give it a namespace. So I'm going to say caching talk NL. Let's see if that's available. All right, so we'll use that as the namespace. And then right now, since it's in CTP, it's only available in the U.S. South Central region. So if you take a look here, you see there's only one data center. Placed into production, it'll be available in all six of the data centers worldwide. So if you're running your application in one of the European data centers in the European region, you'll be able to create a cache in the same region as well to co-locate with your application. All right. And then also, today there are two sizes available in the CTP, 128 and 256. I'm going to talk a little bit about the sizes available later, but come tomorrow in production, we'll see a lot more sizes. I'm going to go ahead and create a 256 megabyte cache. We'll click OK. And so if you think about for a moment what this is doing, this is actually a quick question. How many of you have used Codename Velocity or the Windows Server App Fabric caching? OK, so what Windows Server App Fabric caching is it's the on-premises equivalent of this caching service. And so that's something that you can download, install, and set up in Windows Server, and you can do the exact same thing that this service is doing. You can install it on multiple machines, you can set it up in a cluster, you can create a distributed cache. And it's certainly, pretty easy to do, but it does take some time. It's certainly not going to take 30 to 60 seconds, and it requires infrastructure, and it requires management and maintenance and so forth. And the real value here is that you're not having to do any of this. The bulk of the work is done by Microsoft as the provider of the service. And so this generally takes 30 to 60 seconds to activate. Go ahead and refresh, and hopefully it's faster than usual. But again, even if it's 60 seconds, I mean, think about what it's doing. So it's doing quite a bit. While that's loading, I'm going to show you some of the properties available on the other cache here, so we can walk through some of the details. So up here, we've got some stuff here. So we've got the namespace. That's, you know, what you name your namespace. So in this case, it's caching demo. The region, whether it's active, when it was created, and some subscription and project information. And then we've also got this information down here. So we've got a service URL. It's cachingdemo.cache.appfabriclabs.com. And what this is the endpoint that my application is going to talk to when it's interacting with the cache. And this endpoint is really, it's a WCF service. You communicate to it via NetTCP, and it runs on this port right here, 22233, which is the same port that the Windows Server App Fabric Caching service runs on as well. And so our application is going to be talking to this over TCP at this port. Now, you also see that I have a cache size. You can have pending changes, and I'll get to that in a moment. But we also have this authentication token. And what this is if you think about the fact that my caching service has an endpoint that's publicly available, we don't want just anybody to be able to access it. So the endpoint is secured. And we use the access control service to secure the caching service. And so this one right here, forget the default key, that shouldn't be there. The access token is it's a base64 encoded string that includes not only the name of the cache that you get provisioned, but it also includes the access control service key. And so you can use this information so that when you make a request to the service, you pass this along as part of the request header. And that's how you authenticate to the service, and you can talk to it. All right, I talked long enough. Hopefully the cache has been created now. And in fact, it is. So now we can see here that my my caching talk NL has been created and it is active. So let's look at some other things. So you can see the same information is available for this, just it's going to be specific to this new namespace. And there's a couple of other things available here. So if I take a look here at view client configuration, what I have here is the ability to very quickly update my application so that it knows how to authenticate and interact with the caching service. And so when you take a look at here, what it is a bunch of XML snippets that I can copy and then paste into my application so that it makes it faster to get started. So I'm going to come back to this in a moment. One thing I want to point out is you need to download the Windows Azure App Fabric SDK, and that provides all the assemblies that you can use in order to interact with the caching service. And you can get to that through Home, I believe, and then, right from here. So if you click on App Fabric, you can see here you can get to the Windows Azure App Fabric SDK. In the keynote this morning, I showed an alternate technique, mostly because it's a lot faster and easier to demo in a keynote. But there are also NuGet packages as well. And so you can install a NuGet package, which will download the assemblies needed to interact with the cache. And it'll also update your app.config or your web.config, depending on whether or not it's a console-based application or a WinForm or even a web application. And so what I'm going to do is, rather than use the NuGet package, I'm going to add the references manually so that you guys can see what it looks like. And they're all installed here. So if you go to the C drive, program files, I believe, yep. And then to, I don't know if you can see this, Windows Azure App Fabric SDK. If you explore in here, we'll go to version 2, assemblies, cache. And then there's 5 assemblies. Let me explain a little bit what these guys do. So we've got the caching client, which is going to provide us with the ability to interact for the client that we're building, so the web app or the console app or whatever it is, to interact with and consume the caching service. We've also got core, which really has just some of the base level functionality and pieces of the caching service. And then we've got, which I think is one of the most important ones, the Microsoft.web distributed cache. What the distributed cache assembly is that's what's providing us with the custom session state provider as well as the custom page output provider that are designed to work with the caching service. So these are assemblies that ship with the SDK. So it's a supported assembly. You can leverage it. You can use it. You can feel comfortable using it. You will get support from Microsoft if you have problems. And then the last two assemblies here, the WinFabric ones, these guys, they're actually part of what we call the Windows Fabric, which is really something that you shouldn't have to be too concerned with, but what it is it provides a lot of the underlying routing mechanisms whereby the cache is able to distribute itself across the nodes in which it runs. So I'm just going to go ahead and add all of these guys to my application and get that set. And now that I've added the assemblies, what I need to do is, well, actually a couple of things. We want to make sure first, go ahead and expand this a little bit. We want to make sure that These things are set to copy local true, which they should be by default. And the reason is when we package up this application, we want to make sure that these guys are included as part of the package. Because when we go to deploy this to Windows Azure, these assemblies are not installed by default in the instances that Windows Azure uses. So you want to make sure that any additional runtime engine or assembly or framework that you use is also part of the package. So we check those references. Now I'm going to come to the web.config file, and this is where I can go back to the portal, and I'm going to grab this client configuration information. Now, unfortunately, this is a little bit messy, so you got to kind of see, I went too far already. Got to kind of tease it down. I'm going to grab the two first blocks, and the reason I'm doing that is the very first block here, let me go ahead and make this a little bit bigger. Right here, this first config section, what we're really doing is we're registering the data cache client section below, which has most of the metadata used to figure out how to interact with the caching service. And then below, you'll see here much of the same data that we saw exposed as properties in the portal. So we've got our host name, which is cachingtalknl.cache.atfabriclabs.com, and then we've got our token down here as well. Now, you might notice that it says hosts, and then it's got one host in it. The reason it's got multiple, it's plural like that, is in Windows Server at Fabric Caching, you have the ability to specify all of the hosts that are part of your cluster. So you can have more than one host there. Now, in Windows Azure at Fabric Caching, you don't need to specify multiple hosts because there's one endpoint that you use, and then we manage it as a multi-tenant service distributed across multiple instances on our side. So it's a little bit different in terms of the semantic usage, but it's a consistent model here. So we really only need to specify one host. So that's what we add here. And this now gives us the ability to start interacting with it. So at this point, what I want to do is start updating my application. And I should first probably tell you what this application does. I realized I hadn't done that. So let me run it real quick before I start writing some code to use the caching service. What this application is it's a kind of a basic product catalog system. It's different from what I showed in the keynote this morning, because I kind of built that one from scratch. What this one is it's called the Azure Store, and it's got a bunch of products that are stored in SQL Azure, and whenever this page is loaded, what it does is it pulls from SQL Azure directly. So if I hit F5 and refresh it, each time I refresh this page, it's going off to SQL Azure using the Entity Framework to query some data, pull it back down, and then I display it in this products list. And then I can also add some items to the cart. I can go to checkout and use the application like this. So it's a pretty simple application. And what I want to do is use the caching service to demonstrate the cache aside pattern, where instead of always going to SQL Azure, what I want to first do is check to see if the data exists in the cache. If the data exists in the cache, that's great. We don't have to go to SQL Azure. We don't have to query. We don't have to put any pressure or do any activity against the database. We can just return the data. If the data is not in the cache, then we want to call to SQL Azure, grab that data, and return it. So I'll show you how this works. So, and one thing that I'm going to do as well is I have this application already deployed out into Windows Azure. So this is the exact same base start point, no caching involved, it's just SQL Azure. And the reason I want to do everything driven from the portal is, again, the caching service is a network service, and I'm not going to really be able to demonstrate to you guys the low latency that is involved here if I'm always hitting the cache from my laptop, because it's traversing the Atlantic and it's going to be hitting the US South data center. So what I have in my application, and if you guys are at all curious as to how I do it, I'd be happy to show you a little bit later. But if I come here to properties, I have an after build action script right here, a post event build. Let me show you a little closer. That what it does is it calls a command and it points to my current application, and it creates a zip file based on all the bits. And then that command takes that zip file, and it uploads it to Blob Storage. Then my application that's running in the cloud is monitoring Blob Storage. Anytime a new package is created, it grabs it, unzips it, and updates the application to use that new app. So what I'm going to be able to demonstrate is, after I build, within about 3 to 4 seconds, my app will be updated in a durable fashion across all my role instances in Windows Azure. And that's what I think is kind of the best and easiest way for me to demonstrate the caching service. So hopefully, I don't want to confuse anyone here. This is just a way that I'm going to try to go demonstrating the lower latencies that we'll get with the caching service. So all of that said, let's start taking a look at it. So what I want to first do is show how here in this application running, again, it's running up in Windows Azure. If I hit F5 and refresh, you can see that the latencies, well, this one's going to be a little bit longer because I left it. But generally speaking, when I'm refreshing, the latencies are pretty low, so 10 to 13 milliseconds. And so SQL Azure does a great job caching the execution plan when it's a simple execution plan and there's not a lot of traffic. The problem is if I start generating a lot of load, at some point, since SQL Azure is running on commodity hardware, there's going to be a point at which it just doesn't do the job that I want. So start generating some load. Let's see, maybe I need to generate... you know what? I already deployed my update. Well, at any rate, given a lot of load, this application is going to start getting more and more latent. And so what I want to demonstrate is how I can deploy the caching service so that regardless of the load that's running, it'll always stay fast, and the caching service reduces the pressure on the database backend and thus allows us to start scaling linearly because we don't have to worry about all the challenges in scaling out that database backend. So I'm going to go ahead and come to my service. And here I've got a product repository where all I'm doing here is essentially calling get products, and I'm creating a new context with the Entity Framework, and I'm performing a query, I'm casting it as a list, and then I'm returning that list. And so I'm going to introduce the cache and use a cache-aside model here. And so I'm going to create a private static. Now, the reason I'm creating a static data cache factory is it turns out that creating the data cache factory is a slightly expensive operation. So when I create a new instance of this, it generally takes about 75 to 150 milliseconds. And if we do that with each call and we have to continually recreate that data cache factory, we lose the value of the cache. And so by creating it as a static, it means that I get to at least keep and preserve that data cache factory in memory. And with each subsequent call, it doesn't need to create a new instance of it. So I'm going to create the data cache. Oops, I didn't name it. Data cache factory. What I'm also going to do is create a new constructor for the products repository. So I'm going to say public products repository. And then in the repository, I'm going to say if data cache factory equals null, go ahead and create a new instance. So this way, when I call out to this service, to the product repository service, if the data cache already exists, I won't recreate it, and thus I won't pay that overhead for creating that new data cache factory. Now, in my get products, what I'm going to do is I'm going to create a data cache. And I'm going to set it equal to the data cache factory. Now, I know I showed everyone this morning, but I want to spend a little bit more time explaining what this actually is and what this means. So within the Windows Server App Fabric caching, you had the concept of a named cache. So I could say data cache factory dot get cache parentheses and then give my named cache. So I could tell what named cache I want to interact with. Since the caching service itself doesn't have the concept of a named cache. When I create a service namespace, what it is it's creating a named cache for me, and I interact and I work with that named cache through the get default cache. So when you're interacting with, even if you take a look, and the reason I mention this is if you take a look at any of the Windows Server App Fabric caching documentation or code, you might see slight different use of the model and the semantic here. So just know that with the Windows Azure App Fabric caching, you're going to use the get default cache. So we'll get the cache, and then now what we're going to do is we're going to say products equals that data cache, and we're going to get the products item. So we're basically saying get the products, and now since we're loading it out of the cache, we need to serialize it back into what the object is, and so here we're going to say back to a list string. And this demonstrates one of the I think really cool aspects of the caching service is that as long as it's serializable, you can put any .NET object into the cache. Which is pretty neat. So you can create your own generic lists, you can create your own objects, and as long as you make them serializable, and as long as they are serializable, there's no problems putting them into the cache. So that I think is pretty cool. Oops, and I forgot as. All right. So now we've tried to get it out of cache, so we want to check to see if it exists. And so if products does not equal null, we're going to return it. That's great because we can return it right here. We never have to hit the data tier. However, if it is null, we're going to come down here, we're going to get this data, and then we want to say, go ahead and put it into the cache. Oops. And then put the object. Okay? And so we go ahead and put it in the cache, and then we go ahead and return the products. Now, one thing that I'm going to do here, just to make it easier to demonstrate, is I'm also going to say, I'm going to insert another item. I'm going to insert at the very top of the list something that says from database. And I'll explain what I'm doing in one moment. And then here, I'm going to say products 0 equals from cache. And this way, when I deploy it to Windows Azure, based on what gets loaded up, you'll be able to tell, based on when I refresh, whether the data is coming from SQL Azure or whether the data is coming from the caching service. This is because I'm not running local and I can't just put a breakpoint here. So we're going to do a build. You can see it's building down here. It takes a moment because it's also deploying it to Windows Azure for me. All right. And let's go ahead and come back here and should reload in a moment. And we'll demonstrate this thing in action. So we should expect to see the latency reduce actually quite a bit. So we'll refresh. Now note, it's going to when I refresh, I have three instances running here. So depending on how the load balancer routes me through the load balancer, I could hit one of the instances. So that's why I paid that compilation penalty. But now that I've hit everything at least once, you can see that our latency is actually quite a bit lower. And even though you may say to yourself, well, 4, 5, 6 milliseconds, that's not that big, consider it under substantial load. Our data tier is not going to scale quite the same way our caching service is. Again, the caching service is distributed in memory. And so it's designed to deal with high load. So you'd expect to see this latency stay low regardless of the amount of traffic that it's being hit. All right, so we've done that. We're using a network caching service. But there's one other thing that I want to show as well. Within the Windows Azure App Fabric caching service, even with the Windows Server App Fabric caching product, is something called local cache. And what local cache says is you can also benefit from the memory located on the client. So this is running up in Windows Azure. It's three instances. Each of those instances also has RAM. It's also got memory in the machine. And so if I use the local cache, what's that saying is use some of the memory available in the client as well. So don't only grab it over the network, but check to see if it exists local in memory on that machine. And if it does, use that. And so we'd expect to see a substantial performance increase, because think about two things. One, you're not traversing the network, so it's a lot faster because there's no network hops, and because it's stored in memory local, you don't have to serialize the object, so you don't pay the serialization cost as well. So it can get that, it can reduce that latency to almost nothing. And so let me show you what that looks like. So here, and it's really just a configuration change. When we create this data cache factory right now, we're just using the default settings, which does not include the local cache. And so what I want to do now is create a data cache factory configuration. It's a long name. I'm just going to call it config equals a new data cache factory configuration. All right. I'm also going to create a data cache local cache properties object. I'm just going to call that props. And I'm going to create a new instance of that. But what I'm going to also do is specify some values there. The first is, and apologies, this is kind of probably hard to read. The first is object count. And what that means is it's defining how many objects, or up to how many objects, do you want to be able to store in the local cache. So think about every time I do a put with a different item, how many of those do I want to support? Also, there's a default timeout, so that's how long until you evict this stuff from your local cache memory. Do you want to keep it in local memory for 5 seconds, a minute, 10 minutes? I mean, it's largely going to be dependent on what that data is and how often it changes. You also then specify an invalidation policy. Now, with Windows Server App Fabric, you can do two types of invalidation. You can do both time-based, so just say, hey, after a period of time, evict that data. but you can also do notification-based invalidation. What that means is you can actually set up hooks so that if the data changes in the database, you can notify the cache so that it can evict or update that data. It's a very useful feature. It is not available in the version 1 service for the Windows Azure AppFabric caching. So the only option we have right now for invalidation is time-based. We absolutely will provide notification policies in the future. It's just not part of the V1 of the service that's being released tomorrow. So all of that was a lot I said. All right, let's go ahead and create it. So I'm going to say go ahead and put 1,000 objects. I'm going to create a new time span, and I'm going to say store it for 30 seconds. And then the invalidation policy I'm going to choose is going to be timeout based. And so we've created that. Now what I'll do is for our data cache factory configuration, there is a local cache properties, and I'm going to set that equal to props. Okay? And then now I'm going to take that configuration, and in the constructor of our data cache factory, I'm going to add it. So basically, when we create now our data cache factory, it's going to use the values we specified in the configuration and local cache properties. And so essentially now what we've done is we've turned on the local cache. So I'm going to do a build, which is going to redeploy our app to Windows Azure. Give that a moment as it does its magic. And then go ahead and refresh the page. So again, the first time, let's go ahead and refresh the page. All right, good. Must have hit it while it was still deploying. So we'll go ahead and start refreshing. And after it's done that first time, remember the first time what it's doing is it's going to hit the network service and grab it out of the network service, so you'll see that performance. But now as I refresh, 0 milliseconds. And that's because every time I do the get, all it's doing is going into memory and getting that object back out. So really, really fast. So you basically see kind of three different tiers of caching available here. We can cache data local in memory on the client, we can cache data in the caching service, or we could just continue to store data in SQL Azure. And so it gives you a lot of options to choose. Like, let's say you're running an e-commerce site. Well, you may have those hot apps that on the homepage of that application always get hit, right? I mean, no matter what, every user is going to see these hot apps. It's a great place to put data in the local cache. Maybe then you've got product data that 60% of your users end up seeing. Put that in the caching service. And then maybe there's the product description and product details, which they don't get called all that much and so forth. Go ahead and call it from SQL Azure. So there's just a couple of different options here and different ways that you can slice and dice it. So that's the caching API. A couple things I want to point out is when I've presented this before, people have said, oh, well, can you only specify the local cache properties programmatically like this? And the answer is no. You can also go into config and update the config so that by default, it's just using local cache. So that's certainly an option. Another thing people say is, hey, can I only specify the username, and or it's not the username, but the security credentials as well as my cache endpoint in configuration? And the answer is no. You can also programmatically do all this as well. So one tactic, and I'm kind of getting ahead of myself, but one tactic I see a lot of people use is use multiple caches within their application. They manage it all programmatically, and then they can route between the different caches. So there's absolutely the ability to fully leverage the APIs in your applications to do everything you do in config as well. And vice versa, you can config the local cache in config. So that's the first demo. So that was my overview of the caching service. We covered a lot. So to kind of refresh and restate what we've been talking through, again, it's a distributed memory cache specifically designed for applications running in Windows Azure. Now, that's not to say that you can't use it on-premises. Just realize that you're going to be paying a network cost because you're going to be running across the network to hit it. Very easy to administer. You saw me create the cache pretty quickly. And it's also based on the existing Windows Server AppFabric caching product. It is a 64-bit caching solution, with low latency, high throughput. One thing that is very cool is you can dynamically increase and decrease the size as needed. So let me show you what I mean by that. If I come back to the portal, you'll see change cache size. Here, let's see. Let's go ahead and choose this one. So turns out you can change the cache size once per day. So if my cache currently looks like it is a 256 megabyte cache, I can change that to 128. Maybe I find that I'm not storing that much data in the cache and I don't need to pay for 256 megabytes. What I can do is come here to change cache size, and go ahead and choose 128 and click OK. Now, what's cool about this is even though I'm changing the cache size, I don't evict all the data. Now, certainly, if I have 256 megabytes of data stored in cache and I go to 128, it's going to evict the oldest data. But think about even scaling up. Let's say I decide, you know what, I'm finding that data is getting evicted too quickly from my cache, which means that I don't have enough cache available. If I need to go from 256 to 512 or 1 gig or 4 gigs, when I make that change, I don't evict or invalidate any of the data in the cache. So it will preserve that data for me. And that's one of the values of the caching service. Question?
How can you monitor
your... Great question. So the question is, how do you monitor the cache? Sadly and unfortunately, right now today, we don't expose this data through the portal, and we don't have a feed for it. It's absolutely something we're going to support. In fact, I don't know what Clemens talked about in his talk, but we have this concept of a comp app or a composite application as part of AppFabric as well. And a big piece of that is all the monitoring and management aspects in which this data absolutely gets served up. So one of the things to do now is kind of more manually through the APIs, taking a look at how many items do you have in the cache, how large is it, things like that. So certainly can be done. Unfortunately, you don't have a lot of metadata coming through the portal at this time. So you just have to take a look at, you know, take a look at performance, see how quickly things are being evicted and so forth, and make some determinations based on that. But very good question. So the being able to change that up and down, I think, is a pretty cool and unique thing. All right, what else? And that last point, I mean, not having to deal with the configuration, deploying, managing, all those things about your cache, I think is a very valuable thing. Again, that's that value of this being a platform as a service, right? Because you've got these building block services that you can use and compose within your application. I loved Scott Hanselman's theme of Legos today, because not only did it apply to what he was talking about from the web stack, but absolutely that concept of Legos that you can plug in when you need them applies to Windows Azure as well. We went through a lot of these things. Some of the key differentiators to call out is the out-of-the-box providers for session state and page output caching, low latency with the local cache. That local cache is an awesome feature. And that local cache does allow you to use some of the available memory within the web tier. You can cache any managed object as long as it's serializable. And you're not going to pay those serialization costs when using the local cache. And it's an API that I think if you look at it, it's a pretty standard factory API, pretty easy to use within applications, and the API is symmetric to the Windows Server App Fabric caching. So if you are using that today, if you're using that on premises, you're not going to have to significantly rewrite or really rewrite much at all in order to use the Windows Azure App Fabric caching service. And of course, it's secured by our good friend the Access Control Service. So what I've already demonstrated to you is one of three application patterns that I'm gonna talk through and demonstrate today, and that's reference data. And reference data is typically this data that is authoritative data that's periodically refreshed, but not that often. You get a lot of accesses, so a lot of reads, but not necessarily a lot of writes. And the classic example of this reference data is product information. And so that's what we saw in that last demo. So we implemented a cache-aside pattern for product catalog or reference data. We also have activity-oriented data. And so this is data that's generally that is typically generated by the application based on usage. Typically needs reads and write access. And one of the most common scenarios is the shopping cart, right? Because you add items to the shopping cart. You can remove items from the shopping cart. You can read items from the shopping cart. And we also see the session state. Session state, data being stored about an individual and about that individual's session gets stored within the cache as well. And so that we see lots of patterns using this activity-oriented data. And in a moment, I'm going to show a demo of that. And then the last thing we see is this concept of resource-oriented data. Now, this is against the kind of authoritative data, but it's also temporal in nature, meaning that it changes often. Usually a lot of reads and often, you know, a lot of writes and maybe sometimes not as many writes. But what's important to understand about this resource-oriented data is that it's short-lived in terms of its duration. And the examples here, like flight inventory or stock quotes. I mean, think about stock quotes. What do you generally care about most? The most recent ticker value. And so that stuff can be changing very, very rapidly, but regardless of when you pull it, you want to just get that latest version. And so even though you're doing a lot of writes, you're also doing a lot of reads, but that data is changing pretty fast. And you use the cache in this resource-oriented world so that it very quickly and efficiently is able to pull this information. So I'm going to show two applications building off of those last two patterns. For the first one, I'm going to actually use it demonstrating our existing application here, the Azure Store. Because again, what I've got here is I've got this running up in the cloud with three instances running. And by default, I am using in-memory session state. If you look at the application in the web.config, it doesn't find anything. I'm not implementing any kind of session state provider. So it's using the default, which is in-memory. And what that means is that I will see inconsistency in this data. So if I start adding items to the cart, go ahead. Already you can see something weird is happening. I'm adding things, but they're not disappearing. Right? Well, what's happening is, as I'm clicking, with each request and then post back, each time I come back and forth, the load balancer can send me to a different instance. And so if I'm putting this catalog or this shopping cart information into the session state, I can be putting it into a different role instance and a different set of memory. And when I do that read back, I'm going to be reading from a different role instance. So depending on which role instance I'm hitting, I'm seeing different data. So it can really cause some confusion. I've seen on the forums and from a bunch of folks a lot of confusion about this. And so if I come here, look, I mean, you can see here, I've added the same data multiple times. And that's because each time I've added it, it's gone to one role instance, but each time I've read it, it's come from a different one. And so you see this inconsistency in session state. And this has been a problem, I think, for a lot of folks in that we don't have an officially supported external session state provider for Windows Azure until tomorrow with the caching service. And so what we can do here is, if we come back to our portal and look at the client configuration information, one of the things that we also provide here is, voila, a session state, set of session state tags right here. So I'm going to grab that, and in my config, under system.web, I'm going to go ahead and paste that in. And so what we can, let's take a look at this. And what we've got is a custom session state provider that's using the Microsoft.web.distributed cache assembly, one of the assemblies that we've added. And this is designed and created specifically to work with the caching service. So let me go ahead and build this again with my magic post-build action. It's going to deploy the application into Windows Azure. And then after a few moments, when I refresh, I should expect to see this running nicely. And only by updating the config, that's all we ended up having to do is we updated the config. And so even though we're still running across three instances, all of those instances now are externalizing their session data into one state, into one place. And so I can add the item to the cart. It disappears as we expect it to. It is a little, well, there we go. Should still have really nice performance. And then if I come to checkout, regardless of how many times I click it, regardless of how many times I try to refresh the page, regardless of which role instance I'm hitting, my session state is consistent across. So, all right, I see a lot of nods, so I think everyone gets the point. It's a nice way to externalize that activity-oriented data. So, I probably shouldn't have done that, but oh well. Now what I want to do is show an example of more resource-oriented data. And so what I've got here is, it is something that is creating fake ticker data. So I don't want any of you to look at the stock values that are going to come up in my application and go, oh my gosh, I need to buy, or oh my gosh, I need to sell. It is a demo. It's not real data. So, but what I'm doing, and I'll show you the code, it's not the prettiest code, but essentially what I'm doing is I'm creating a couple of lists in a dictionary in which I initially seed it with some stock data. And then essentially I walk through it and I just do puts. I just keep putting data into the caching service for each one of those tickers. And then I've got some code here that, again, isn't all that pretty, but it just creates a bunch of random data within a specific period because I want to have it go up and I want it to go down and I want it to kind of move that data around and to look like real stock data. And so I have that, so that's just running in the background. It's just a console app that's just generating a whole bunch of data, and it does it very fast, or at least as fast as the network allows it to do. And then I've got my web application. Let me go ahead and do a build here. And this should deploy it out to to Windows Azure for us. And what this is, it's a very simple MVC3 application that uses JSON along with AJAX to call back to our controller and get the latest stock ticker value and then return it back to the page. So you don't see the postbacks. That's the beauty of jQuery and AJAX. And every 750 milliseconds, it just gets the latest ticker value for that data, and it refreshes the data on the page. And then based on its movement, it's either going to be green or red. So that's built. Let's go ahead and stage this up. So I'm going to start this application here. And what we're going to see is it's just going to start churning out and creating a whole bunch of data. You can see here, just a bunch of random data. Again, this stuff changes all the time, and all I really care about is the latest value. So now if I come here to my application, now the first time it's going to have the wrong CSS file because it's all called site.css, so it's going to look funky, and then I'm going to refresh it, and it's going to look great. And what we can see here is if you watch over here, see that data is changing. And so what's happening is, there's some jQuery script that's very simple. I can show it to you if you'd like. And it's just going back through the home controller and just getting every 750 milliseconds the latest values. And that's not necessarily concurrent with the data that's being written into the cache. So there's two different things going on here, right? Is the cache is always going to have the latest value, and then based on when I do the pull here, I'm going to show that data. So this demonstrates kind of this activity-oriented view of our session data. So, of our data stored in the cache. Any questions here? How is session timeout handled? Yep. So the question is, how does session timeout occur, and how does it get removed from the session state and so forth, or what happens? Since it's a custom session state provider, it's tied to the cache invalidation policy associated to the time-based timeout. So if you leave it by default, I honestly forget what the default, if you don't specify it in config is. I'm sure MSDN documentation says it somewhere. But that's what's going to also invalidate it in the session world as well. If you change that, it's going to also update and reflect that within your session state provider as well. Yep, another good question. All right, let's go ahead and stop this. So hopefully a decent demonstration of it. All right. So sizes and capacity planning. All right. So these are the sizes that are going to be available in production. Everything from 128 megabytes up to 4 gigabytes. And so again, consider the fact that you can dynamically change the database size. So honestly, in terms of capacity planning, to me it makes most sense to estimate on the small size, kind of monitor your caching usage, and if you need to increase it, just increase it up. Makes it pretty easy. These are the different sizes. Just out of curiosity, does anyone think that we're not providing either a small enough cache or a large enough cache? Would you ever store more than 4 gigabytes? One thing So the next thing is you can absolutely, and this is why I mentioned before the ability to programmatically construct your data cache factory with all the configuration information. You can use multiple caches if you need to. So if you did have a scenario where your application, you wanted to store more than 4 gigabytes, you could create 2 4-gigabyte caches and then use them both in your application. And then what you're doing is you're creating your own concept of a named cache. And if you have certain types of data, you know to look for it in this cache, and the other types of data, you put it in this other cache. It may make a lot of sense if you, let's say, have session state or kind of activity-oriented data. Maybe it makes sense to put it in its own cache and have a specific invalidation timeout period for it. And then maybe you've got other data that's more reference related, and you want to make that timeout period a lot further, you can do that as well. So there's different ways to pivot it. So you don't necessarily always have to put everything in one cache. You could look at having a couple of different smaller caches and segmenting your data there. And I already got ahead of myself, but again, yes, you can increase and decrease that cache size dynamically. Now, pricing. I would love to be able to talk to you about pricing today. Unfortunately, it's one day too early. So we're going to be announcing the pricing tomorrow morning Pacific time. So let's see, Pacific time. So let's say it's 9 a.m. It'll be about 6 p.m. tomorrow when we announce the pricing. So if you go to the Windows Azure at Fabric team blog, I don't remember what it is. You can Bing it or however you do search. You can find that team blog, and you should expect tomorrow morning to see all the pricing information as well as the SLAs. The one thing I will share is that it's all going to be dependent on the cache size. So it's specifically attached to the cache size. So you can expect that a 4 gigabyte cache will be more expensive per month than a 128 megabyte cache. Why not make the size dynamic? Do you mean in terms of pricing? Okay. Yep, so it's a great question. So the question is, why not make the size dynamic or more elastic, right? You know, just keep giving me more data, you know, increase my cache size as I put data into it. It's a good question. It's certainly something that we're looking at for the roadmap, but it turns out that that's actually also pretty hard to do as well. I think for this version one release of this, you know, we're trying to target something that's useful, provides value, and is also accomplishable in the time frames that we want. I mean, if we wanted to hold it for another 6 months or something like that, maybe we could get it in the first release. But just in terms of what we're able to provide today, it is something that you will manually change and resize. But you know, we've heard both in software design reviews with customers as well as the MVP summits that dynamically having it adjust is something we want to see, along with checks and balances, right? You may only want it to scale up to 1 gig and not to 4 gig. But it's a very good point. What I thought you were going to ask was about pricing. And I did want to say that, let's say you start off the first half of the month with 128 megabyte cache, and then you bump it up to 4 gigabytes for the last. You're not paying the price for 4 gigabytes the whole month. It is going to be prorated on a daily basis based on the cache size. So it will be averaged out. All right. So one of the last things, and I'm seeing that I'm going much faster than I thought it was. But a couple of things I wanted to talk about. One is, you know, what are some of the options and what are some of the differences as we see it between using this as a managed service, so the Windows Azure App Fabric caching service, or doing it yourself? Because certainly you can do things like run Memcached in Windows Azure instances. In fact, even Channel 9 today at Microsoft uses Memcached for in-memory distributed cache. Of course, as soon as this goes into production, we're going to try to get them to use the Windows Azure at Fabric Caching Service. But you can certainly use Memcached today. Now, a couple of things to talk through. The first is this idea of dedicated memory. So when you buy a cache with Windows Azure at Fabric Cache, you get that much RAM dedicated to you, right? If it's 128, you get 128. If it's 4 gigabytes, you get 4 gigabytes. When you instead purchase, let's say, a small instance in Windows Azure, you get 1 gigabyte of RAM, right? That's how much RAM is associated. I think it's 1 gigabyte. Maybe it's 4. I don't remember what it is. But you get a certain amount assigned to you, but you don't get to allocate and use all of that RAM. Only a certain amount of it is addressable. In fact, with 1 gigabyte, you're probably only going to be able to address 250 megabytes in RAM. And so you got to consider the fact that it's not always going to be a one-to-one comparison between a 1 gigabyte cache size in the Windows Azure App Fabric caching service as it is to a role instance that has 1 gigabyte of RAM. So that's the first distinction to make, because in the role instance, it's only going to use a portion of the instance. The second is ease of use. So certainly being able to run something and use it as a service, I would say, is simpler than having to provision role instances, deploy your software, configure it in a cluster, monitor it, manage it, and maintain it. So with Windows Azure and it being a platform as a service offering, this is one of the things we're trying to get rid of. We want you to build applications, not worry about running the infrastructure for those applications. So ease of use is another one. Distributed. When you think about being able to seamlessly grow and shrink, with the caching service, it's, you know, you flip a switch and you accept it. Whereas if you're managing this yourself, you're deploying new role instances, you're hooking it into your cluster. I mean, it's a lot more manual, not as easy to do, and it's going to be limited by the capacity that you have available and the costs you're willing to pay for that added capacity. And then the last point is SLAs. So with the Windows Azure at Fabric Caching Service, there is going to be an SLA. It's going to be a backed SLA. And it will guarantee a certain amount of uptime and availability. Now, let's say you run Memcached in a set of role instances. Certainly, Windows Azure and those web roles can have SLAs associated to them, but Memcached running inside of them does not. So you don't have the same guarantees of that service running and having the same uptime. So that's kind of a perspective of, can you do it yourself? Certainly. In many cases, and maybe some cases, you want to do it yourself. But I would argue that in most of the cases, if it's provided as service at the right cost, you can use that service. I'll talk through a couple of best practices. Now, we went through three patterns: reference data, activity data, resource data. One thing I want to point out is that a cache is not a database, and it doesn't do what a database needs to do. The Windows Azure App Fabric caching service today is not durable, so it's not backed by a durable store. What that means is, if there is a failure, some data could be lost. So for instance, let's say this cache, our distributed cache, is running across three role instances. I don't know how many it's going to be, but I'm going to say hypothetically three. And let's say there is a hardware failure, and there can be. I mean, this is still, it's hardware. Hardware fails. If one of those role instances goes down, you could theoretically lose, 33% of what you had stored in the cache because it's not backed by a durable store. So you could certainly, if you're implementing something like the cache aside pattern and, it's not in the cache, okay, no big deal. I go get it and fetch it, no big problem. But if you're using the cache as a database and you need that to be durable, well, this is a problem. So just note that it's not backed by a durable store today. What I want to point out, though, is that Windows Server at Fabric Caching does have a high availability option, which does durably store the cache data. And that is something that the team is also working on for a vNext release to include that concept of having a highly available cache, which would provide that level of durability. That doesn't mean that you should consider it or use it as a database. Just I want to offer that as a data point and an option. Local cache can really help maximize the benefit of the cache. Having that data stored locally in memory and using some of the available memory to you, I think is just a added value. Note that it is based on time-based expiration. And the other thing is that it is more volatile since it's using RAM on the disk. If another application or another resource, let's say you've got some process that starts consuming a lot of RAM on the disk, it uses the local cache, it considers it to have a lower priority, so your data could get evicted from it based on something else consuming a lot of memory. So keep that in consideration. It is considered a little bit more volatile, but again, if you're able to use it and benefit from it, it can add a ton of, orders of magnitudes faster than the network service, from 7 milliseconds down to zero. And one thing I do want to point out, too, is even the network latency of 5, 6, 7 milliseconds, which I think is pretty low, we're trying to get even lower. So we should see, even with some service releases in the future, that number growing even lower. Now, there's two additional services that I didn't talk about in this talk. I did talk about this morning in the Windows Azure Update talk, and that's the CDN and the Traffic Manager. And I'm not going to go into a whole bunch of detail about it, but when you're looking at building applications that reduce latency and increase performance, you should really take a look at these two services as well. The CDN is the Content Delivery Network, and what it does is allows you to cache data closer to the users that are accessing it. So we have 24 CDN nodes, so 24 CDN data centers worldwide. And when you leverage the CDN, what happens is when I make a first request for a resource, it's going to check the closest CDN based on DNS routing, see if that data is available and cached in that data center. If it's not, it's going to send me back to the origin or to Windows Azure Storage or to a Windows Azure role instance. It's going to grab that data from the origin, pull it into the cache, store it there, pull it into the CDN and cache it there, and then return that data to me. So if you consider, if I'm the very first person, there's a little bit of a performance hit because, we're doing a couple of hops to pull it. But then every subsequent user that's in my area, when they make a request for that resource, it's going to check that CDN. It's going to find that data is cached there, and they're not going to have to go off to the origin in order to get it. So the CDN is a great way to really reduce the latency for your end users and to create a better experience. And, it's great for videos, images, even things like XML documents if you're using them in some kind of a way. And with compute, if you attach the CDN to your compute instances, you can also put things like CSS, you know, style sheets, even JavaScript, things like that into the CDN as well. So there's CDN, and then there's Traffic Manager. And what the Traffic Manager is well, it's actually called the Global Traffic Manager, and it's essentially load balancing for compute instances, and load balancing for compute instances even across data centers. So if you consider the fact that I may be running my apps, in fact, I'm running my application today in the U.S. South data center, that means that if I'm, you know, if I'm in Texas or if I'm somewhere in the southern United States, I get great performance, low latency, it runs fast. If I'm running it from Netherlands, it's a little bit slower. I'm going to have some network latency, you know, and it's going to probably be some significant network latency. And the global traffic manager says, hey, go ahead and run your application in multiple locations. So I can run it in the US region, I can run it in the European region, and I can run it in Asia, and have my same application running in each one of these places. The global traffic manager then will take a look at the origin of the user and where they're coming from and route them to the nearest data center. So I can reduce the latency. So if I were then using the traffic manager for this application, instead of being routed all the way to the US, I would be routed to the European region and the European data centers. And there's three different types of policies that you can attach to the global traffic manager. The first is performance-based, and that probably makes the most sense. Just do whatever's fastest for my end user. Send them to the fastest place to give them the best performance. So that's one option. The other one is failover or fault tolerance. So that let's say you know, a data center can crash. I mean, we've seen that, you know, big data centers can have problems and not be able to serve up resources to users. And so rather than having users trying to hit a data center and just having everything fail because it's not available, route it to a version of the application and service that is running. So let's say a comet hits the, you know, one of the data centers in the European region, or maybe something more realistic, there's a DNS outage or something like that. Rather than having an issue and have our users not able to hit the application, the global traffic manager can say, okay, well, I can't access this resource, route them to North America or route them to Asia. So that's the second one, fault tolerance. And then the third is what we call round robin. And specifically what you can do is attach a ratio to how you direct your users. And I think one of the interesting ways to use it is to say, let's say I have a production version of my service running, and I have some updates or features that I want to roll out, but I'm not quite sure, you know, maybe I'm not sure it'll work. I'm an awful developer, and there might be a lot of bugs, and I don't want to bring everything down for everyone. Or I'm just not sure if people will be confused, or they won't like the feature, and so forth. So I could define a ratio that says, send 95% of the traffic to my existing production instances, so that most users aren't impacted. But send 5% of the traffic to a couple of updated instances that I'm running somewhere else. And in fact, they could even be running in the same data center. Send 5% of the traffic there. That way, I can kind of test things out, and I can maybe I've got a lot of analytics built into it. I can see if people are clicking a button or they're not clicking a button or whatever. But I'm not impacting the vast majority of my users, just a little bit of them, just a few. So that's the traffic manager. Definitely a service you want to take a look at. And in terms of a best practice, I mean, honestly, what I see is in many applications, you deploy your web application to role instances in each one of the major regions, so the US, Europe, and Asia. You provision a cache in each one of the regions. So you provision a cache in the US, Europe, and Asia, so that they're co-located with those applications. And then you use the traffic manager to intelligently route your users to the closest data centers. I think that's a brilliant way to do it. You also would use SQL Azure in each data center, and you could use the SQL Azure Data Sync service to synchronize those databases across. So I think you start looking at some of these services and using them along with each other, and you can come up with some pretty compelling use cases. All right, and back to that sticky session state limitation. So the fact that the load balancer does do a round robin on you and will, you know, you don't go back to the same role instance each time you make a request, the session state certainly can help with from a state sharing perspective. This is what we were talking a little bit about before. Definitely do some sort of capacity planning or optimization or testing or whatever you want to call it to see how much stuff is being cached and how often that cache is being invalidated. Because you don't want to, what we want to do here is really reduce the pressure on that database backend and instead use the cache where we can. And of course, locate your caches along with your applications. So, We've got some time for Q&A, so we'll go through a quick summary. Hopefully you'll leave the session thinking that you can build high-performant and low-latency web applications using the caching service. Simple to administer, simple to create, hopefully simple to develop against. Scale up, scale down as needed. And a couple of things. Let's see, is this updated? So we've been in CTP since October of last year at PDC. And by the end of this week, we'll be in commercial launch. Doesn't look like I have it, but one thing I definitely want to make sure you're aware of is that we won't be charging for the service until, I think, August 1st. So even if you haven't tried it in the CTP form, you can still try it when it's a production service without any cost until August 1st. I think it's August 1st. You know, that way you can still try it out and give it a spin. And with that, if anyone has any questions, I'd be happy to answer them. Otherwise, we can all disperse. Question? Is there a way to use IP affinity? Maybe explain a little bit more what you mean by that. Do you mean like... I see. So if a user comes in and hits one server, is there a way to guarantee that when they have subsequent requests? Make it likely. Well, so by default, no. But what you can do is, so really the load balancer will just distribute the requests in a round robin fashion. So it's just going to hit it. However, searching memory databanks, in IIS, there is a IIS extension. It's completely escaping me at the moment. That essentially allows you to use this IIS extension and will help enable, is it like a, I'm completely drawing a blank. There is a, I think, an unsupported scenario where I think you could create that kind of affinity, but it's using an IIS extension, which really means that when you deploy your web role, you're going to want to create a startup task that will install whatever this IIS feature or extension is that I can't remember, install it into all of your role instances, and configure it to kind of simulate the ability to have a sticky session or IP affinity. It's not something supported by the platform per se, but it is something that I think you can do via an IIS extension. And as soon as we're done, if you want to come up, we can do a quick search. I'm sure Bing can help us figure out what it is. So I'm just drawing a blank. Can you use the CDN for other data other than blobs? So yeah, so when we first released the CDN, it was really just tied to Windows Azure Storage and blobs specifically. When did we announce it? At PDC last year, we announced the ability to support it also in putting some of your static resources in your compute instances on the edge as well. So if you think about like building a web role, and in your web role you have an ASP.NET web application, you have a bunch of JavaScript, maybe you still have some images in your web role, maybe you've got style sheets, whatever it might be, you can, through convention, have it set so that any data stored in a particular folder in your web role will also be attached to the CDN. So when your user goes to hit it, any resources in that folder will get cached at the closest CDN point. One other thing that was recently announced at Mix is that very soon the CDN will support smooth streaming as well. And even though that is tied to blob storage, it's also an IIS feature, the smooth streaming. So we're going to be supporting smooth streaming through the CDN as well. Also, I now support HTTPS, which is another useful thing, especially if you're... How many of you have gone to a secure website, HTTPS, and someone has an image that's just HTTP, and suddenly the browser pops up saying, hey, you've got an unsecured resource, do you want to load it? And you're like, yes. So the CDN supports HTTPS so that you don't get that kind of malicious attack. So the question was, I talked about how you might want to make a distinction between storing things in local cache or the network service, or you know, kind of do some different things. And I think it depends on the use case. I mean, it depends on the type of data you're storing. Like I think the example I gave before, I may want to use the caching service for session state data, and I would want to invalidate that data over a period of time, maybe a long period of time, right? Maybe I want that data to persist in the cache for, you know, as long as possible. And so I might configure it in such a way that maybe it lasts for a day, maybe it lasts for a week. But I might have other data that's reference-oriented data that I want to make available in the cache, and I want it, but I also want it to be reasonably up to date. So let's consider, like, it's an e-commerce website, and I've got hot commodities, or like the fastest selling or the best selling things, right? It's on a page that it might get refreshed every single time. Now, it's a great candidate for putting in the local cache, but I may not want it to be cached longer than 60 seconds. And so I would attach a different time, you know, expiration or invalidation policy to that data than, let's say, the product catalog data, which I don't want to invalidate, you know, except once a day. So there's different types of data that, depending on how you're using it, you still want to benefit from it being in the cache, but you may not want to have the same types of time expiration associated to each of them. And then another things as well, like mentioned that the local cache is volatile storage. Plus, you know, if you put a whole bunch of stuff in memory in the local machine, consider that it is using resources on the machine, and it's possible that it could impact how your app is running. So you just need to find the right balance between what you're putting in local cache, what you're calling through the caching service, and what ultimately you feel comfortable calling to the backend database for. I'm pretty sure that if you look at the MSDN documentation for Windows Server App Fabric caching, it's got all kinds of white papers on when to use what, because remember that these concepts have been around with Windows Server App Fabric caching for over a year. I think there's a lot of information published on patterns for using it in different cases. So, any other questions? All right, well, great. Well, thank you guys so much for coming and sticking around until I think this is the last session, at least for the normal tracks. I think there's some other stuff going on tonight, but thank you very much, and if you have any other questions, come on up and ask.